This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. It's a rather special edition today as we celebrate our 500th episode of the show. Almost 10 years ago, in October 2011, Section D, as it was known back then, arrived on the Monocle 24 airwaves, and it's taken 500 episodes, a name change, and the tireless efforts of countless contributors, producers, hosts, and editors to get us to where we are today. In this celebratory episode, we catch up with some of the figures who have helped define Monocle's relationship with design over the years. This includes our editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, and creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Since the first issue of Monocle magazine hit newsstands in 2007, urban design and architecture, and the role it plays in making our cities more livable, has been at the forefront of our coverage in print and on radio. It's only natural, then, that we kick off this milestone episode with Monocle magazine's founding editor and current editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck. He sat down with this show's researcher, Nick Manise, to talk about how his own experiences have shaped our design coverage over the past 14 years.
I guess as a starting point, for you, what constitutes good urban design? What's that first thing you're looking for?
When we started looking at cities, you know, the thing that we felt was going on was you had these big mega projects going on. You had, you know, cities doing a lot of spin about how they were going to be like big tech hubs and all of these grand projets. And we suddenly realized that the things that make a city actually desirable, which make you think this is somewhere I want to spend my time, are often smaller design details. So across those last 10 years, we've tried to hone in also on smaller things. So are there interruptions on the street where you can sit, you know, a bench, somewhere you can catch your breath if you're older? Does it feel safe to wander around? Is there adequate space for your bicycle? Is there a place to lock your bicycle up safely? Is the city built on a scale that makes you feel not overwhelmed by it? So, you know, are apartment blocks, you know, 5, 6, 7 stories high rather than 80 stories high? So all these small nudges that actually make somewhere, I don't know, just connect with you in a more emotional way than thinking about always the biggest piece of infrastructure you could be putting in, for example.
And I think, you know, this obviously I've joined a number of years since the magazine's been going, since this podcast has been going, but certainly from my perspective, I guess that emphasis that we've had on human scale in terms of design, which is sort of what you're touching on there, you know, welcoming building entries. What I'm curious is where you developed this way of thinking. Do you have any formal training in architecture? Have you read a lot on it? Or is it just something that you sort of picked up and felt and then started to look at actual architects and designers and the work that they were doing?
Well, I think the good thing is when you're a journalist, you get to meet a lot of people. And to be honest, that's where the knowledge has come from. In the early days, just going to as many conferences as was possible, meeting lots of people, hearing their ideas. And then the strange thing is that after a while, you begin to see what's a bit of hokum and what's kind of genuine. And you get tired of hearing people kind of banging the drum for these and kind of, you know, new cities that are going to appear out of nowhere. And then suddenly you meet somebody who's just like really honest and engaged with the simple things about what makes a great city. And those are the people we came back to again and again and again. So, yeah, it's completely self-taught. I certainly have no architectural training. But I don't think that is important in a way, because the work we do in the magazine, with your show, with the Urbanist show that we do, it's all about this notion that everybody should have a part in the debate about what happens in their city. So good design, of course, you know, you want an architect involved, you want somebody who's trained in that world. But in the end, it doesn't mean anything unless people think it's something that's for them. And so we've just been keen, I think, always bring people into this conversation. Say, look, you know, you have an opinion. What do you want for your community? What would make it work for you? And often, as we said, it's not the biggest fix. There's often very simple things. And also, sometimes it just needs a bit of storytelling around things to persuade people that good ideas are good. You know, people are resistant to change, and we've wanted to be part of that. So it's not about being a genius expert always. It's about the ability to listen, to bring together some ideas from various places and present them in a way that people think they can connect to.
I'm curious as well in terms of, you know, you played a big part in selecting this office space that we're in. I guess I want to give it a grounding in something physical that perhaps our listeners can relate to. We're in this beautiful, is it 1950s, 1960s building that's been converted into lovely offices. What were you looking for in terms of design when you were coming, I guess, to set us up here?
There are a few things that appealed about this building when we walked in. You know, one of the things we all want is, you know, to have less dependency on air conditioning, on ramping up the heaters. But this building is clever because it's narrow enough that you can open windows on both sides and have a through draft. So even in the summer, we rarely put on the air conditioning. It's built almost like a boat, and with on one side these kind of decks that lean out from the building, and then there's a huge canopy of trees next to that. So you get shade and you get very nice filtered light into the building. So it's a nice place to work. It was a building that had good bones. We didn't want to be somewhere that had just been knocked down and rebuilt. We think this building, whatever happens in the future, should be looked after and protected. It's a really wonderful building. And you want somewhere that brings people together. So we, you know, had a space for a kitchen, a space for our teams to dine together. So again, it needs to be a bit of a social space as well. It's not the most expensive office in London, and it's not filled with incredibly expensive pieces of art or anything like that. But whenever people come in here, they love it. There's something about it that's, again, on a human scale, that connects with people and that feels sustaining, I think, when you're here.
And I guess that's why I wanted to bring it up. I think for me, good design doesn't have to be remarkable or striking. It just needs to sort of make you feel a certain way. And whether that is, you know, a green outlook, plenty of airflow, nice natural light, big windows, I think those sorts of things, you know, maybe get lost in a star architect's work when we start to look at marvelous and amazing structures. And I think good design, and that's something that we've certainly championed and you've championed here at Monocle over the years, can be something that can just sort of happen every day. With this in mind, is there, and I'm going to put you absolutely on the spot here, do you have a favourite architect or a favourite designer with regards to the built environment that you would always look to or point to as someone that delivers outstanding work?
The person you gave an award to recently, David Chipperfield, again, you know, could be called a star architect in some people's minds, but he certainly doesn't behave like one or act like one. Uses honest materials, a clarity of decision-making, of the built product that comes out at the end. But I also think that, you know, you have to look at some of the unsung heroes of architecture. You know, who are the people who built good housing in London across generations? Who are the people who did that in Stockholm or in Milan? And, you know, for me, it's everywhere needs to have this flavour, something that's particular to it. And also that you want architects and builders who understand a little bit of serendipity, of, I don't know, surprise in the things they make is also important. So it's not just about building beautiful, strong, clever, idealistic buildings. It's also about this notion that there's a quirk that keeps you attached to a place.
And then I guess just finally, 500 episodes, 14 years of the magazine. What can we expect in terms of our coverage for the next 500 or the next 14? Are we going to be looking for the same things? Is our design mindset going to shift? Where do you see things going?
Well, just look at all the funny little changes. You know, even just a few years, it only feels like a few years ago that we were writing about, you know, the first timber towers being put up. Now every city has a timber tower. It's only a few years ago we were talking about the rise and rise of cycling. Everybody knows that's at the forefront of urban planning now. So lots of things that we've watched come to the fore have really taken off. And what's interesting to think about is we've had this year of the pandemic. Everyone's questioning what the city will look like in the future. But I do think there is going to be a really exciting moment of real proper sustainability coming to the forefront in our cities, and not in a way that beats people over the head. It will just be part and parcel of how we make and run our cities.
That was Monocle's editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck speaking to Nick Manise. Monocle creative director Richard Spencer-Powell is the man responsible for our brand's trademark visual identity. Here he provides insight into how Monocle's aesthetic has developed over the years, and he also gives some advice for designers on where to find inspiration. But first, Richard begins by taking us back to the early days at Monocle, sharing what shaped those initial design decisions at the company.
We had been working our way through a non-compete clause, so we weren't in the magazine business. And for 4 or 5 years, we were working with branding, custom publishing, logo design, packaging. And that really kind of honed our skills a little bit more, so that when we went back into publishing, we came with a more rounded skill set and a lot more branding ideas. We thought a lot about what we didn't want to do, what we didn't want to be, how we didn't want to pander to photographers' portfolios, how we didn't want to do styling in a very played out way. We wanted to do journalism in a particular way. We'd go back to former sort of approaches where we would have longer form articles, we would make sure that we had reporters on the ground, we would shoot film and be analog. I think we wanted legibility, to be original, all original artwork, no calling artwork, every image to be shot. We wanted a good view on illustration, and we wanted something elegant and timeless, and something that we thought would last a long time. Design would last a long time, the product would last a long time in your month, so there was a lot to read, we would pack a lot in, and to deliver a lot of added value. You know, no story could just be 1,000 words and one picture and that's it. We always wanted to go the extra mile, give the extra bit of detail, an extra bit of finesse in the design, in the typography, with legibility being quite key and emphasis being on the written word, and just try and do a very proper job of journalism, magazine making, the art of magazine making. So the starting point was to set the bar quite high. And once we kind of understood that and we're all agreed on the approach, the design followed that brief quite quickly. I went to Zurich with Tyler for probably, I mean, as quick as 48 hours. And in 2 days studio time, we had pretty much a solid backbone for the first issue. Those designs, they lasted from the prototype, or the dummy as it were, right through to the first issue. I would say sort of 80% of it stayed, and it stayed for a long, long time. We were very kind of monochromatic and type heavy, you know, typography led, but we also wanted to add in some elements of flair, some mixed stocks. It was an interesting book. The tactile quality of it was very important to us. Portability is important, so the trim size was short. We opted for a bulky paper so that it feels bigger, but it is lighter. So yeah, overall, the things we wanted to achieve were many, and that was always the challenge, to pack so much in and but deliver the quality on each and every component. Around, you know, the 7 year mark, we started to think about a little bits of innovation, bits of spring cleaning. The covers developed from 1 to 5 quite quickly, and then steadily they got more and more busy. After sort of 7 years, we started to think a little bit about changing things up, but I think we were probably too busy. We had one eye on the 100th issue, and we waited right until the end of the first decade for our first major overhaul. To recap that first 10 years, it was a lot of adding to the design, adding to our editorial lineup. We stretched our legs and did newspapers and additional titles. We expanded the brand in terms of retail, radio, of course. So we added in a lot of stuff, which kept us very busy. But once we got to the 10-year mark, we thought, okay, let's stop. Let's draw breath. Let's review what works, what doesn't work. What's run its course, what's changed in 10 years, what needs to be updated. And in a similar way to the first creative burst, we went to Zurich, and it was Andrew, Tyler and myself, and we sat around the office and we had a good stack of mags and we pulled them apart, and I think Tyler was quite rigorous in pulling it apart and saying, okay, let's drop that, let's add this. And it was much more of a rethinking, actually, of the structure of the magazine, all of the furniture, and not just an exercise in tweaking the typography. So it was a major redesign, actually, and again we went back to legibility. We were a bit older, maybe our eyesight was getting worse. We decided to tweak the grid a little bit, and we ended up with sort of slightly increased legibility, bigger point size, and oddly more words on page. So we ended up actually delivering a bit more, and that has been coming on 5 years for the first major redesign. And we're still trying to innovate and evolve at a reasonable pace. We don't want to reinvent for the sake of reinvention. It's not a fashion magazine, and that's something we also never really wanted to do. And it just has to be done in a very sort of measured, considered way. We've got a lot of people at Monocle that have been here from the beginning. They're all swimming in the same direction, so most of us know what the right and wrong routes are. Now, of course, you know, every now and again, something will challenge us, or we'll throw a curveball to the readers. We still want to sort of delight and entertain at times. But for the most part, I think it's an instinctive checklist that we know what it is that Monocle should be doing. So we kind of veer left and right a bit when new things happen. But for the most part, it's just knowing the brand, really. It's just, it's simple as that. It's like, how do you know what to wear every day? You've got a set style, you know. We're not, you know, in the fancy dress cupboard. We know what our style is. And although if I look at what my cut of jean was 10 years ago, it might be different to today, probably not that different. So I think it's an instinctive style, really, of knowing what it is that we should be doing on any given day. Being a designer, maybe this is just me personally, it's been a lifelong pursuit and a joy, but it's a slight curse as well, because you can never turn your design eye off. Which is a good and a bad thing. So, and I think I will always say to anyone that's in design, that's starting out, you have to get out in the world and see it, because it's everywhere. And if you want design inspiration, take a street in London, walk down Jermyn Street and look at every sign of every shirt maker, and you'll find 150 different logos, 150 different typefaces, colours, patterns, everything. The inspiration is out there for people to go and see. And I think that is the best way to do it. And that isn't being pro-analogue and anti-Instagram. I think travelling the world is about having a thirst for knowledge. And you have to go and you have to look. And I think you can find inspiration pretty much anywhere if you're prepared to kind of pay attention and open your eyes. You know, I've been very fortunate. I've travelled a bit with work, and whenever I travel or wherever I go to a museum or a gallery, I always make sure I visit the gift shop, I look at the books, I look at the magazines. If ever I have a day trip to see a publisher in Germany or wherever, I make sure I spend as much time as I can after the meeting, before the meeting, just packing in, even if it's a 30-minute visit to the bookstore, just to pick up, check out what's out there, and always be looking. We're big fans of the mid-century design here at Monocle. Tyler's taught me many, many things about interior design and architecture and product design because he has such a vested interest in it. And when I worked with him for many years at Wallpaper, I was surrounded by it, and you couldn't help but have that sort of seep into your system. You learn everything about design when you're at school, not just graphic design. So you learn photography and you learn fashion and you learn illustration, and of course, you learn about interior design and architecture. So the grounding is there from an early age, and all designs of interest to me, as fashion is, as architecture is, as Brown's, you know, big thumb button cigarette lighters are. It's there to be enjoyed. Good design makes your life better, and I firmly believe that, and living with that knowledge, you know, I can only but pursue it.
Thanks to Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. Now, Fiona Wilson, our Asia editor and Tokyo bureau chief, has been at Monocle since the very first issue of the magazine. Over the years, she's reported on numerous architecture, design, and craft stories from all over Japan. I recently sat down with Fiona to discuss the importance of Japanese design at Monocle and to shed some light on some of her personal highlights. Fiona, we're celebrating the 500th episode of Monocle on Design, and we're looking at, I guess, different aspects of design that we cover at Monocle, and there's no way we could do this without talking about Japanese design, because it features in basically every issue of the magazine, lots of our radio shows, we're kind of fascinated by it. You've moved to Japan a long time ago, a fairly long time ago, from the UK. So I'd love to kind of hear your feelings and what kind of inspired you when you first got there and you saw Japanese design and how things were done, from everything from architecture to graphic design. What kind of caught your imagination straight away there?
Honestly, Japanese design was pretty much the main reason I moved here. I was so interested. At that point, I was really interested in Japanese architecture, very interested in people like Tadao Ando. And what's really interesting is, you know, these architects were really open to being interviewed. So, you know, you could go to Tadao Ando's office, you know, you could end up interviewing absolutely anyone. And, you know, the more I learned, the more I realized I didn't know, which is always a good feeling, but also just the more there was to discover. And I still feel that way. Honestly, I feel like you could be writing about Japanese design from now until whenever, and you still wouldn't do much more than scratch the surface. There's so much that's interesting, and just also how it connects. And I think anyone who's interested in Japanese design also really needs to get to grips with traditional Japan, because a lot of design comes out of, you know, it's very old style, the way people built houses, these really old buildings in Japan. They really inform the way design has progressed. So for me, when I first got here, I spent loads of time looking at temple shrines as well as contemporary design, and it all connects really, really well. So over the years, I found that I've dipped in and out of so many aspects of Japanese design, but in many ways, craft, design, architecture, art, it really connects. So, and I'm really lucky that at Monocle, we've been able to cover so many of those aspects.
I'm really interested in, I guess, this mixture of contemporary and I guess classical, and the links that they have between each other. Because if you're in a city like Tokyo, you know, you're surrounded by so much newness. And from what I understand, they do tear down a lot of old buildings there, sometimes often beautiful buildings, to replace them with newer builds. But then you say, you know, there's always kind of a trace of the past in the new architecture. So where do you see that, and how does that kind of happen?
Yeah, I think for me, that was really hard at first, you know, coming from Europe and where you feel an old building is worth saving. Why would you just tear it down? And it's really different. The attitude here is very much about renewal. You know, if something's outlived its useful purpose, just tear it down. People are not as sentimental. Certainly they retain these incredible old wooden buildings, these amazing temples like Todaiji, or, you know, any other number of beautiful old buildings. But domestic architecture, you know, 30 years and your time's up pretty much. So that was a bit of a shock to me. But what's interesting is the rebuild and the renewal just opens up the design space for young architects, young designers. And also it keeps a lot of these crafts alive, because you find carpentry is absolutely brilliant here because there's so much building going on and houses are still wood framed. So you've got incredible sort of levels of carpentry skill here. And, you know, I think it really helps people understand Tokyo if they just accept this constant renewal. You know, you walk down a street and you go a year later, it will probably look a bit different. So I think that has been a big thing for me, accepting that. And I have seen some buildings I really love disappear. But, you know, the renewal is also really exhilarating. It's quite exciting. So it's sort of accepting the difference. And, you know, when it comes to craft, which I've been really interested in over the years, that is an amazing story of continuity, people doing the same thing for generations. And I love that coexisting with this incredible renewal that we're talking about.
You said before, when you kind of arrived in Japan, you were fascinated by architects like Tadao Ando. It's been quite amazing, even in the last 5 years where I've been looking after the design pages of Monocle, the amount that we're seeing Japanese architects and designers have real success beyond Japan. So Kengo Kuma, for example, is kind of everywhere now. So Fujimoto as well. You see a lot of his work. You know, these architects who are based in Japan are now establishing international offices, winning huge competitions. What do you think is driving that?
You know, initially, when I first came here, you're right, it was a certain sense of mystery. People were really fascinated by Ando, particularly, you know, this way of working in concrete in a modern way, this kind of super clean concrete. People, I think, say in Europe, were thinking concrete, they associate it with this brutalism and often quite a rundown kind of concrete. And Ando was showing concrete can be this incredible material. And it reshaped the way people, I think, all over the world who are interested looked at concrete. So I have to say, I credit him with a lot of that. And I think also architects here are much more open to commissions outside Japan. I think a lot of times people were like, oh, that work is really interesting. I wonder how we'd get in touch with that person. But the architects are more switched on now. They're going after bigger competitions outside Japan. So you're right, you're seeing all these architects like So Fujimoto, Kengo Kuma, absolutely. And I think what's interesting is what they bring is a sort of level of the finish is something else. A lot of architects here talk to me about that they find it quite hard building overseas because people here are such perfectionists, they wouldn't accept a kind of lesser level. and that they sometimes find that a bit frustrating, but that's the kind of level of professionalism they bring, you know, and their detail of the work. And I think what's also interesting is that people are very interested in Japanese craft as well. You know, that has a potential for a huge market outside Japan. So I think that's all to be discovered. And I think in a small way, you see maybe like Isamu Noguchi's Akari lights, these lights that are made from shoji paper. You see them all over the world. But actually, when you see how they're made in Gifu, in the middle of Japan, it's absolutely incredible. They're handmade, basically. I love that sort of connection there. The shoji, the paper that you see in the sliding doors in any house, traditional house, that design, the Akari design, is completely timeless. So there's just so much. It's such a rich vein. I feel very lucky that I've covered so much Japanese design.
And just finally, I've only been to Japan a couple of times, and most of the time I've been in Tokyo. I did manage to get up to Hokkaido to visit Time and Style and see how they were using these old growth forests to create absolutely amazing timber furniture with such a level of detail and care that you've kind of already talked about. So perhaps for me and also for our listeners, where would you kind of recommend beyond Tokyo, just a few places to really experience that kind of craft and design culture and, you know, immerse themselves in it?
I mean, that is a great question. You know, if you want, in a way, a shorthand, because craft is all over Japan in the most obscure. I've been to the tiniest villages. You could go to Kyoto, incredible density of craft there. And then if you're really interested, companies like Maruni, it's this amazing industrialized craft that Japan does really well. They make wooden furniture and it's done by machine, but the human touch that finishes it is so important. So that's in Hiroshima Prefecture, really, really interesting. And if you go to Gifu, highly recommend Gifu. It's got everything. It's got, you know, people making lanterns. It's got the handmade paper. It's got incredible wooden furniture in Takayama. So Gifu Prefecture is a great starting point for anyone who wants to get a little taste of Japanese craft.
Fiona Wilson, our Tokyo Bureau Chief and Asia Editor. And last, but certainly not least, it's time to reflect on the design of the latest addition to the Monocle family. It's our sister publication, Confect. We hear from Sophie Grove, the magazine's editor, and she tells us about the visual language and aesthetics that make Confect such a distinctive sibling.
Confect was launched in 2020, and it's a quarterly. So we're following the seasons and we're a larger format to Monocle. The quarterly metabolism just gives us a little bit more room to breathe, I think. We like to take our time to report things and give each story a lot of space. So there are 206 pages in Confect. It's a tome that people can really keep with them through the season and read the essays and make their way through the pieces on fashion and the road trip stories we've got in travel and also on craft and design. There is just a slightly slower, roomier feel to the whole project. There are a couple of things we're trying to do very consciously, and one of them is to present an image of real women and looks that are fashionable and inspiring and beautiful, but quite, I mean, something you just want to grab and put on. We don't want there to be anything in the magazine that our readers don't, you know, feel they can relate to. So the fashion, it's very chic and it's very elegant, but there is a sense that it's quite wearable. One of my favourite shoots from this issue, which is spring 2021, is a market shoot in Nice. And it's just got all the energy of, you know, a kind of wonderful brocante on a Sunday morning with lots of bunches of mimosa and lemons and great sense of energy, but then also wherewithal of everyday life. So there's kind of little trolleys that they trundle so chicly in France, but then also great looks, jackets and really elegant silhouettes. So we try and combine those elements. The other thing is that we're not afraid of a little bit of decoration. And there's definitely a sense of abundance and opulence in the design section that perhaps you won't see in Monocle, for instance. We feel that there's a real depth and value to some of these quite intricate prints and quite kind of flowery and very elegant palette and design that to some extent has been eschewed by quite a few sort of mid-century connoisseurs. I mean, we have some beautiful mid-century furniture in the magazine. Actually, our fashion shoot at the gallery Nullifer in Milan is just beautiful. But we also have a kind of wonderful, rambling, old palazzo in the design section, which has got a sense of slight faded glory. And it feels like there are lots of stories and just beautiful, elegant old furniture. I think that that's quite nice to kind of free up that conversation a little bit. We're celebrating the value of a beautiful pattern quite often, and in this issue we just looked at some of the Ottoman-inspired designs that you can find at Lobmeyer, which is an amazing crystal house in Vienna, and just looked at the stories behind them. And I think some of that aesthetic is really key to what Confect means, and it is that sense of abundance, history, and those stories that are really also filled with emotion and feeling. And so I think that certainly editorially it's there, but also it's there in our aesthetic.
My thanks to Confect's editor Sophie Grove there. And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our 5-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maylie Evans. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Phil McCourt. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.